Yeah.
Hey now, Gary. It is Wednesday the 6th of February 2023. I'm in Darwin and I'm here to do some interviews for Murubah, the Indigenous Oral History Project, in collaboration with Sydney World Pride, the ABC. And I'm in suburban Darwin in Jingalee and I'm with Gary Lee. Now, Gary, could you introduce yourself as fully as you would like to be introduced?
Okay, my name is Gary Lee. I'm a Larrakia artist, primarily a photographer. And I live in Darwin. I've lived in Sydney, mainly Sydney actually. But yes, so that's me.
Anthropologist though, trained anthropologist.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, well, I am also an anthropologist with honours from the Australian National University. And from there I worked at the Australia Council in Sydney. And then I had to tear myself away at the delights of Sydney. I had to. And I went back to Darwin. And then I got a job. I was first time I applied for the Dulles, I did. And then I applied for a job. There was a job in the paper at Mimi Arts and Crafts in Catherine. And I thought, I've got to try for that job. It sounded, so I did, and I got it. But the boss at the time, and I will tell you, he is the best second boss I've had. I had two very good bosses, Chips McInaughty, and he worked there. And he said, yes, I have every respect for him. So I went there and he said, but then the day before I was to go, I won't say how, but I trained my ankle and I could walk on a bloody crutches. And they said, now come down, you can sit and get better and, you know. So I did that, I went down to Catherine. I loved it. I loved that job so much that that's when I decided that I have to become an anthropologist. And I was meeting a lot of anthropologists through Mimi. I applied for two universities. Sydney University and Canberra, ANU in Canberra. But the thing with Canberra won out for me because I had met a professional anthropologist, Nick Peterson, and I loved, and I also had met a girl. Anyway, so I went there and I decided to go to ANU, and that was the best decision I made because then I got a lot of experience there and stuff. And
let's start at the beginning, though, because when were you, I guess, when you're writing your own story, you're writing your memoir at the moment. But tell us where it all starts, you know, your parents, your family and Darwin.
Well,
what year were you born?
I was born in 1952.
You're the only queer to offer the year they were born, so thank you for that, 1952.
What?
The only queer I've spoken to who's been willing to say what year they were born.
Oh, yes. No, 92. And
52.
And this May, I'm going to be 71.
What day in May?
18th of May.
God, I'm 23rd.
Of May? Oh, May is a good year. I can tell you some good friends.
So your mum and dad, tell me a little bit about them.
Okay, so my mum, her mother was married to John Cabillo, and he was the son of Antonio Cabillo and Lily McKetty. Lily McKetty was the daughter of a Scottish free settler called
William McKetty?
Yes, sorry. And George McKetty had come to Darwin in the very, very early days.
He was one of the first settlers.
He was. His family were living in Gaybock in Scotland, and they decided to sell everything. They were printers and things like that, and moved to Australia, which was really unusual. There was about 11 of them, but they had a bit of money, I think, obviously. So when they came to Australia, they could go anywhere because they were free settlers. They weren't. So that's when George McKetty turned 21, he got his inheritance, which must have been a lot of money. So he decided to come up to Darwin because he had a brother who was working at the Palmerston shop up here. And he came up and worked for us, and so that's how he came up to here. At the time...
So was it Port Essington then, back in those days? It wasn't Darwin, was it?
Yeah, no, it was Port Essington. And George McKinney came up and there were... It's well documented. There's a famous photo of 11 white peer pioneers in Darwin, and they're the businessmen, and George McKinney is there. So at that time, there was the law was that you... that Aboriginal women were not allowed to cohabit, or white men were not allowed to cohabit with Aboriginal women. No. But the irony is there were three main Dutch Dashwood, who was my great uncle, and George McKetty, and there's somebody else, I can't remember it. Anyway, they each had...
Three of these early settlers had Aboriginal wives.
Justice Dashwood. He had a, and she married George McKetty's son, Jack. So
that's your uncle. Jack is, yes. So there was Jack and Lily,
yes.
Or Magdalena.
Yes.
Now Lily is your...
My grandmother.
Paternal?
Great-grandmother.
Paternal or?
And so Antonio Cabillo came from the Philippines, Bohol, and he... came via Sydney. A lot of people were going to Darwin to work in the piling industry or sailing, and he was a sailmaker. And he came, and he was indentured to George McKetty to work for him. And he had a few boats and things. Yes. And he, yes, but the woman he had the two children to, Minnie Doohan, she didn't live with him. She didn't...
Now, Minnie is Larrakia, which is where your Larrakia heritage comes straight from her.
So George would take care of his her elf welfare, and also he was bringing up the two children. They had a faithful caretaker, if you like, or Arfong. And they, you know, he looked after them.
He was entrusted to look after the kids,
yes,
on behalf of George Kitty.
And everything like that, so.
And they carried his name too, like the children.
Kitty, yes, he was definite that he wanted them to take his name. And who was to say anything?
What happened to Minnie?
Minnie kept visiting, and she had another baby, Jack. And then... she was photographed by Falsch, like a lot of Larrakia people, and eventually we don't know what her in the records, but the records for her were lost, you know, but the record for Jack McKetty and his two children were very rich, and he had properties and stations and everything like that.
So Minnie was, you said Falsch. Paul Falsch was the police magistrate in Darwin. He had some kind of official role. He also was kind of a amateur, I guess, ethnologist. He took photographs of all the Larrakia mob.
He was the first police commissioner in Darwin, and he worked for the police in South Australia. But he was also a amateur photographer, and he had one of those... I should know about it. And he brought up, and he started taking photographs of it. But that's why these photographs are so beautiful, because he one thing about his photograph, he really wanted to capture. I mean, he did doctor up the pictures, he made them wet, but that's okay, that's irrelevant.
So some of them were bare-chested, for instance, when they wouldn't have been. There's a picture of Billionbook, that one of the Larrakia elders that Folch took, and it's here on an image that you, one of your works, where you, one of your nephews, Shannon, is the kind of modern day Billionbook.
That's right. I wanted to show the connection between Billionbook, who was 16 in the picture, and I put next to it a photograph of my nephew Shannon, and the falsified is the black and white, and the
beautiful sepia.
Oh yes, and I wanted to photograph him in colour, so I just wanted. I was talking about the beauty, the fine, you know, the proud look and all that. And then I did that with his mother. There was a photo of Minnie and my niece, Mi Kim, who was also...
That's a great...
And she was also the same age as Minnie, so she was 25, I think.
And Billionbook, is there a family connection? I mean, he obviously is Larrakia, you're all connected, but...
There is no family connection with us, no. But I'm
his countryman.
Oh yes. He was the first Larrakia person. When the survey party arrived down at Fox Hill, and there were all these Larrakia people up in the bushes looking, and they were threatening them with the spears. And then as they got up more the hill, they could see these Larrakia people, and they came out. And they were going to throw these spears. And then Billionbook, 16-year-old, he was already a man then, he had and he stepped forward, he stopped them. And he went to he was the surgeon on the... Yeah. And Billionbook took off a necklace of red seeds. And we tried to find out what kind of red seeds, and they were crab eye seeds, the black and red seeds. And he gave it to this, and that was... So then Billionbook was used by sort of like a conduit between, and he became very, very important. He was also one of the first three Larrakia people who were sent to Adelaide by the... But after they were there for...
Did Folch send them?
Yes. They were just... To be on show, yes. And then after they were finished at the wherever they had to do it, guess what? It was like, okay, bye bye.
Make your own way home.
Yes, from Adelaide, and there was one rich white man there. He felt sorry for them, and he said no. So he paid their passageway on a ship, because otherwise they didn't know where they were going. So it was terrible, but that Billionbook was one of those boys. So early on he had an idea of down south people, and you know, so, and then he helped the government before workers.
He was a diplomat, he was also well traveled,
interpreter, all that. And
he's like one of the key Larrakia ancestors.
He's one of the few Larrakia men that is photographed quite often, so from when he was 16 right up until he's 50. So
now your heritage, you've touched on it, I think Filipino, very many Aboriginal heritages, Larrakia being the primary one, but yeah, biggest mob. German? Is there German there?
German, yes indeed. My father's...
Scottish?
Yes. That's on mum's side, it's German on my father's side. His mother... was born south of Broome. It's called the... No, it was on the other end. So you get Broome, and then there was something that's Kadajari, or Kadajari after Broome. And her mother was what you'd say was a light one. yes, light one. She wasn't a dark one. But the father was this German policeman called, how can I not forget his name? It's just there.
Doesn't matter.
It does, because that was her name.
You remember. We'll come back to it.
He was a German. He was a policeman there. He came out from Germany for the war. He went to America. Didn't like it. Went down to on a boat to end up in Perth. Liked it. Talked his way up. And then he was working. Got a job out bush with this coloured girl. He was the nanja of the...
You sure it wasn't Beagle Bay?
No. Beagle Bay was after during the war. So she was living down there. And she also had a brother. And he looked after them. But then when the war broke out, World War One, all Germans became persona non grata. They had to leave. And he'd been here 10 years.
Aliens.
Yeah. And my nana and her brother were taken and put into Beagle Bay, you know, fair as.
What was your nana's name?
Nana Zumfeld, that's the name, Zumfeld. Zumfeld.
Zumfeld?
Z-U-M-P-F-E-L-D-T. Yes.
She's unmistakably German.
And she was very proud of it, that was her name. So that was the name, he gave them the name.
Can I ask, when you were growing up, did you have a sense of all of that? I mean, I know you've done a lot of work to, you know, and your
answer. Do you have a sense of this?
Of just being German, Filipino, Chinese, yeah.
Absolutely. And you'd say, well, how come? Well, my grandmother, she would say, oh, tell me all about her father. He was a German man. He was very good. And that's where she got her nous to be a stunning businesswoman. And she said he was very good. Then during the war, he had to leave Australia. She told me this. So I heard all about it before I went to high school. And he left and he went to Indonesia, somewhere in Sumatra. Yeah. And he started another family. And there's a whole...
Zumfelds.
In Bali. Huh. Not Bali. And I said, well, you know, I was going to do a thing about it, but I haven't. But I'm sure there is names, so I haven't even looked. And then she went to, and then, you know, and then she met my grandfather. Now, my grandfather, my dad's father, he was a Japanese-Chinese man. Yes. So his story...
You don't often hear about that.
I've written a play about his, but I've never done anything about it. And Morris is saying, you should write the play. I said, I've written it. I've just got to, but I'm just too busy. And it's a, well, because when I had the exhibition in Beijing and Kate Kroll, actually we're going to see her next week, she took us around and I was so grateful. So I've never been, you know, and I had my exhibition, I had this, and then the Chinese press came and it was so very, I've never experienced, I loved it. John Mundine was there, oh God, and his girlfriend, oh fuck. And, you know, Morris and Jason Wing was there and he was a bit thing too. And I thought, let's just, you know, don't go out in the streets and you know. And I said somewhere else.
One of your homelands.
And I said, let's go. So while they're eating at the hostel, we went down, we go down here and then there's another one. And then to go to the gateway and there was the local scene. The restaurants and no white person at all. Let's go. We had a ball there. Beautiful food, everything like that. Anyway, what was I telling you?
We were talking about the family. You had a sense of being all of those things.
So my grandfather, my father's father, in about 18-something, I'll have to look up the date, 1830, 40, 50 maybe, Harry Lee Sue. So his name was Lee Sue, but they anglicised his name as Harry, Harry Lee Sue. And he had been living in Darwin for about 20 years. He was a businessman. He made money, gold, pearls, whatever. And he'd go back to, he'd been back to China, Guangzhou, Canton, right? To his home there, and he had two wives there. They lived there for 20 years. They're living there.
Working here, sending the money back.
All that stuff. But he'd go back to Darwin, he'd, you know, and doing, making his money. And then one day he was, apparently this is a story that my aunt who's passed away now, she got the story when she was born, that he was riding his cart down by down by the beach, not the beach, down near the wharf, not the wharf, around the corner.
Somewhere in Darwin.
Down by the water, actually. And he was going back, and apparently he found my grandmother. Now, my grandmother's name was Suye Arase. And when I say that name to people, they say, oh, that's a very old name. And I said, well, that was her name. Was, you know, her name was Suye Arase. I can write it. Anyway.
Where was she from?
She was from Japan. She was a Japanese girl. This makes... People said, you should make this into a movie script. I said, yeah, you got to pay me. And she was tattered and everything. And, you know,
she stowed away on a boat or something?
She stowed away. She came from southern Japan just before the war. And there was just nothing there.
Before the First World War?
Yes. Absolutely nothing. You know, you can imagine. And so...
How old was she when she stowed away?
13. She was 12 when they came and 13 when she arrived. And she and her other girls said, we'll go on this boat and go somewhere to earn money or live, or, you know. And they took off from their home and they stowed away on this boat. That boat was going from there to Singapore, then from Singapore to Darwin, then Darwin to Broome. And I don't know if they were caught on the boat or anything, but they, when the boat came to Darwin, she jumped the ship. The other, her other girlfriend went on to Broome. She jumped the ship and she didn't know what, I suppose she was starving. And apparently she was really starving. And so he took her home and he fed her up and he looked after her. 13, 14, 15, 16, she was... And he said he wanted to, he'll marry her. And by that time she had no deep desire to go back to Japan. I think she just wanted a future for, you know. Yeah. So he married her and then she got pregnant. Happy, happy, happy son. At that time, down in Pine Creek, there was a lot of gold found down there. And
Pine
he
Creek down south?
No, Pine Creek, just before Catherine, yeah.
Oh, just down that way, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there was a lot of Chinese people there working and all Caucasians and everything. And he was actually born in Brock's Creek, which is at Pines Creek. They were living there in the tents, so he shared that. And then they came back to Darwin.
And this is your dad we're talking about now. This is your...
We're
no.
talking about my grandfather.
Your father's father.
Yes. And so when he was about about 5 years old, his father, so he gave the name James Lee. The authorities just...
This is Japanese stowaway?
Yes, Suya Arase, yeah. And he wanted to take his wife, more recently, he wanted to show them. He had a son. Now, he had a daughter in, but not interested, daughter. But here he has a son. Half a Japanese, don't worry. So they went by ship. And I was, you know, I'd go through all the records and can't find a photo of them, but they went to Hong Kong, which was just before Canton, Guangzhou. And they went to his house, and his two wives, two Chinese, well, two very bitter Chinese wives, that's what I reckon. And he came back, not only that he had a wife, Japanese wife, which were like, but he had a son. Anyway, I don't know what it was like for her there, but one day, this is all true, it's just, people think I made it up. The two wives poisoned the food, right? So they put the food, poisoned the food, and they brought the food into him and Su Ye. And they think that she would do the usual thing where she would eat the food, but they're not like that in Australia. So the husband
ate first.
And he dropped dead from poison. And his mother, hello, she's Japanese, she knows that no. She knew that those two women wanted that my grandfather and they were willing to kill her. That was easy. People did that in those days.
So they killed the man that they were married to
and then previously in China. And oh, he died. So the two wives were arranging his funeral thing and while they were out of the house, the little servant girl, it wasn't their daughter, it was a servant girl. She was about 9 and she said, Mrs. Lee, they will harm you, they want the baby boy. And she knew that and she said, oh no, we're getting out of here, sort of thing. So she bundled up her, she had the return ticket, see? And then...
made their way to the ship?
Yes, but she said to the little girl, what, where's your parent? No parent. They will kill me, maybe. And, you know, they would do that sort of thing. She said, no, you can't do it. She said, you come with me to help me with the kids and the baggage and everything. And she had no passport, nothing. They went to Hong Kong, went to the boat, got the thing, and she had no ticket for him, for her. And she said to the... She could speak English, by the way. She said to this, oh, no, she's my... You know, she doesn't have passport. She, you know, she has nobody. She, and the bloke said, oh, waved her on. Now, that lady was the mother of the Kunoi families in Darwin. The Kunoi families, a big Aboriginal family. Big!
Kunoi.
Kunoi.
Their matriarch. And she's a... She's Chinese.
And she grew up and years later after the war, she went back there to see... But anyway, so they took off and they got back to Australia. And then my grandmother's, great-grandmother's paternal great-grandma is buried down at the very first cemetery in Darwin, down at Warden's, down the gardens. And her gravestone is typical Japanese. The Japanese section was here, the Chinese, the green... And he charged her name and it was only
in Japanese characters?
Yeah, yes, because he grew up, she taught him Japanese.
This is James, your grandfather?
Yes, and his Japanese mother, she taught him everything Japanese.
Do you have a photo of her?
I don't have a photo of her. I've looked and looked and looked and looked at. I don't think my grandfather would have had a camera either way. Which is really sad. But The only thing is when he went to Broome, he met my grandmother, the German Aboriginal grandma. Yes. And
he survived the poisoning.
Mary, would you believe it? Mary Lee, like my mum, Mary Lee. And she, he went there and then the next time she got pregnant, that baby looked nothing like. But you know what? Pop-Pop, he was so like everyone. Okay, not my kid, but he would bring it up. And the next four boys were all different fathers, and he brought them up. But eventually, they did an unthinkable thing. They applied for a divorce. Now in Darwin, they say, no, what are these people? And they were given up.
And there were two essentially coloured people? I mean, people who are not Europeans.
Their lives. And then when he was in Broome, he met this other Japanese woman, Gertie Chai. Does that ring that bell? Chai? Jimmy Chai? Jimmy Chai's elder sister, Gertie Chai, met my grandfather. So I had three grandmothers. And Gertie Chai, she married Papa. They moved to Darwin and she lived here. She was So when I went to Broome, I thought, I've got to meet this Jimmy Chai. So Rhonda and I, my cousin, went to the plate, the pub on the thing. And there was a thing for the Pegram brothers and Jimmy Chai signed there. I said, this must be the place. Didn't know who the Pegrams were. Love the Pegrams. Went in there now, and they were singing that song, you know, On the Way to a Brand New Day. That's a brand new day. They were actually singing. I thought, wow, this is a lovely. And they packed, the pub was packed. And he was singing, and you know what? This really happened. He was singing. We walked in, and maybe because we're not local, no, few people looked around, we got a table, and he was singing with Mr. Pegram, and next minute he went like he was really looking me on the side, and he finished the song.
This is Jimmy Chai's, the famous what do you call him, music director, I mean composer, incredible theatre maker.
And he said, he looked at me, well, he didn't know me, he'd never met before, but he looked at me and he said, that boy. And I think, and Rhonda's like, he's pointing at you. And I said, what do you? And he said, come. And I thought, oh no. And he said, where are you from? And I said, I'm from Darwin. And then he said to me, and I said to him, no, Gertie Chai is my nana. Wow. I was that drunk when I left them. And every couple of years I went down to see Jimmy. And then another time when I was working in Sydney, the brand new day was playing in Sydney, and I was at the Australia Council that time, and I went to, they were having a rehearsal, and there was Jim, come, and there's this famous, people say, photo of me, Peter Yu, and Jimmy.
Kimberley Land Council.
Yeah, at the time.
And Jimmy Chai.
Aboriginal mafia. I can't find that photo. But anyway, so Jimmy, and so I connected with him, and he was, oh no, this is, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I had a connection to him and my Japanese grandfather. He married Gertie Chai. It's fabulous.
Let's talk about the immediate family, because your family history, we could spend days talking about it. It's so fascinating. But yeah, so there's 10 of you, I think, in your family?
Nine. Sorry, I gave you the wrong thing.
And you are the eldest boy and the second child.
And then later on, my when I went to ANU, we had a terrible tragedy. My cousin, she met an Aboriginal guy from Port Hedland, and he... You know, they had four beautiful kids, and then they moved down to Port Hedland. He did. And they were there, she was there with the four kids. She was being a good mother. And he came home one day. The eldest of their kids is one boy, then there's two girls and another boy. The eldest boy would have been about 9. So he can see, you know. And the other one was, you know, 7, 6 and down. And their father was a real asshole, terribly good looking, but absolutely nothing there. And a drinker and a spending her money and a pitch and all that usual story. And he came home one day at lunchtime. It's about 1 o'clock or nearly 1 o'clock. And she was cooking. Getting lunch, making sandwiches or something for the kids. And he grabbed that knife and he stabbed her to death in the kitchen and in front of the kids. So what I didn't know that we found out that those four kids were going to be sent to Perth to some home. And my father said, no, I won't do that. So he worked for the government at the time. So he and Mum went to Port Hedland and they agreeably adopted these kids. So there's 10 kids in our nine kids in our house, and this other four, and rah. But he saved those kids in a way, you know.
And they're your cousins? Are they... They're related, they're blood relatives?
Yes, they are.
Grew up like brothers and sisters.
Oh, yes. So their grandfather was my mother's greatest, eldest brother. So he is... And Denise, what I was talking about before, she is... This girl was Louisa. She was so beautiful. I loved her. Anyway. So that happened.
That often happens with black fathers. There's more... Well, just... More people coming into the family home and the family home having to accommodate more than just people in the immediate nuclear family.
Yeah, it was like that.
So now, we're going to be talking about a couple of things, but I want to kind of go to when you realised that you were queer or you were gay, mm-hmm. and what that kind of meant to you and how you managed to survive Darwin in the 1950s and 60s?
The thing was, it was a bit different from me. I knew when I was about 8 that there was something wrong because I was taken out of the awful Catholic school here, St. Mary's. Love you, St. Mary's. And it had to do with this ring. It's a long story. And the nuns... I was 8 and it was my birthday. My auntie Nolene, who went to that Greek wedding, she loved me. She had no children. Her husband was an Irish man, blonde hair, blue-eyed, absolute. But she was... And she couldn't have children because he was impotent. He would say, it's you, but it's not her. Anyway, so she'd always look after me. And she put me in front of her. She had this cabinet where... opened up and this little ballerina went around and she put all her costume jewellery on her. And I thought it was the most beautiful thing and I would sit there and play with her. And she loved it. She let me go.
And there was a ring in the display cabinet.
So when I went to St. Mary's, oh my gosh. And my cousins can tell you stories about that place.
I went to Catholic school too.
I went to Catholic school and I'm always proud of it. And I do all the things, you know, I
went to church.
Everything.
Altar service.
Holy Communion, yeah. Confirmation. You know, we were there. Mum was there.
Did that come down through the Filipino side that you had to be Catholic?
I think so. The Filipino side. Filipino.
So the ring, you St. Mary's, they threw you out?
Me a little ring for my birthday, a signet ring, and it was one of those 9-carat little shield rings with a little red ruby. And I, prior to that time, I never thought about rings or jewelry, never looked them. But because it was on my thing, I thought, it was just the most gorgeous thing. So I wore it to school. And Sister Killian, I put her name there. She's dead long ago. But I put her name as Killy, Sister Killian. We'd say Sister Killam. Killam too much. Sister Killian. And she had an eyes like a thing. The minute I walked in, she said, Gary Lee, come here. To the front, like really rough, gruff talking. That's what they did. And I didn't know what she was talking about, so I went up there. She grabbed my hand and she ripped that ring off, really rough. And I said, my ring. And she had a big glass jar. She unscrewed it and she dropped the ring in there and she had little bits of jewelry and other things that were confiscated by all the students. And things, they looked like a gold bracelet there. And I thought, but the mothers would say, oh no, that's not the right, we didn't do the right thing, so it's okay. And then at the end, and the nun said, well, at the end of the year, you can get the ring back. oh, all year I'd sit there. And they, but in between, they'd be making the kids. You'd be having, and then we had to learn Latin. And I said to Mum, and French. Grade four, ridiculous.
In Darwin, yeah.
And then if we weren't, no, she'd get us to mow the lawns or pick up the stuff. And I can remember one time, I'll put this in my memoir, my memories of the Catholic school, that, you know, there's prayers before lunch, prayers after lunch, everything. We all sit around eating our sandwiches, okay. You see cousins and everything, you know. And then one day, this white boy, now his family is, I think he's, I still see his name, Pius, I won't say his name, but this poor boy, he came to school. They were white people. Poor people. Somebody said, white trash. I said, don't say that. You know, they were good people. And he came in the singlet. So what? Wow! And anyway, so the nun to you know, put him in his place or whatever. He at lunchtime when the bell would say the prayer, you know, and he would walk around in this big, it's still there, a big square where we'd be all sitting around, and he would have to walk around while we were eating. And when he started to do this, us colored, we'd look and say, we didn't see anything wrong with that singlet. And this kid, and he was crying. And he was made to go around and walk around. Honestly, I'll tell you, they said they wouldn't do that. I said they did it because we saw. Walked around and pick up any bits of crumb or crust or anything, dirty old crummy crust, on the lawn. Now, the grounds were pretty clean. But occasionally there'd be a bit of...
For wearing a singlet?
Just on the ground.
For wearing a singlet, that was his punishment for wearing a singlet.
No, it gets better. Then he was to wear that rubbish he picked up. And I said...
Oh. How do you mean wear it?
No, eat it.
Oh, my God, you're kidding
me. Yes. Admittedly, he only got a handful of crumbs. Still. The crusts. And he was crying, poor Basil.
So
and I went home, this and I was upset, and I said to Mum, you know what? Those nuns, and she started to, no, she was very Catholic school, Catholic church. But in the end, my mum, and I said to, and but Dad was very interested in education. And he said, what? He said, what? I said, they may, and I was, anyway, but when I went home to tell him that day that they took the ring, he said, oh, all right. So my auntie bought me another one, had a blue stone, and said, just don't wear it to school. It's all right. So anyway, at the end of the year, I went to get the ring, and the whole jar was empty. And I said to her, where's my...
I sent it all to Rome.
But I said, can I have my ring back? And she goes, what ring? There is no ring. You can see it's empty. Out, that was it. I was bawling in the morning. And then I said to Mum, you know, when I had to go to the fucking piano lessons. Now, I never seen a piano. Okay, Lee's next one. Oh, sitting there, you could smell that piano, you know, very. And now we can just, that's the first time I've even touched a piano. And the second thing I got wrong, and she whacked me, but it wasn't that hard, it was just a tap on the knuckles, but after about four or five taps, and I couldn't, and I went home and I was bawling, and I said, what's wrong? And I was bringing home all these horrible stories, and one part where Cherry Cabrillo, my dearest cousin, she's still alive, when she was about 2 years before me, she was in the great, say, oh, whatever, and all the Aboriginal girls, I even asked him when I sit with his old grandma's name, you remember that? Oh, yeah. And the nuns were making typing on that. Oh, and they did wrong, and they'd be cracking that.
Yeah. It happened at my school too.
And so Cherry got up and she just shoved that typewriter out onto the floor. Wow, that caused a riot. And, oh, she stayed home for a week and she was bad. But anyway, They were not very nice. So
they're tough. So when did you? We're talking about the ring, but I guess when did you have a kind of a real kind of sense of, you know, of being gay and of being homosexual, if we can use that word.
Well, they sent me to this is a good way to get this. Sent me to prep primary school, which was like I was so fantastically free. But unfortunately, they said to me, you had to repeat that year because the standard of the English in at the high school, St. Mary's, was not very good. And I thought, no, but there I was, I did it. And, you know, this Miss Team, I've never forgotten her name, plump one, young one. And if they found a child had a bit slow, they would appoint a remedial teacher with them. And you leave with them for half an hour on Friday, and, you know, and I like that. Help you made me, you know, appreciate English and literature, and then she'd... But Dad also give me books, but anyway, what did I do? Well, yeah, I started because we'd moved from prep camp at that time to Fanny Bay, which was one street ahead, away from the beach. But I'll tell you, my parents, so by the time I was 16, I had left Darwin. I'd hitchhiked to Sydney. The first time I experienced any racism was in Townsville, when this girl said, what are you doing in this shop? Like that sort of thing. Anyway, I let them end up going to Sydney, working for the... work as the circus.
Circus?
Glorious.
What were you doing in the circus?
I went to Sydney. I had no address. I had nothing. But I was sitting there. I got to Sydney and I had about 40 cents in my pad. But I loved it. I went down the first night I went in Hyde Park. There's a big statue of...
The Archibald Fountain?
No, before that. To Captain Cook in Hyde Park. And I had nowhere to. And so I... At the bottom of that, there was these bushes and I snapped in there the first night. Never mind.
At the base of the statue of Captain Cook in Hyde Park.
Dad found me. So I got up and I walked down with him up to King's Cross and there's the cross. And it was like buzzing. I was starving and everything. But I loved it. I sit there near the fountain and prostitutes and American service. It was all very swinging. It was great.
What year was this, you reckon?
69? 68? How old were
you? No. I was 16.
So you're
born in 52? 52. Mm-hmm. So that's... I was not 70.
Mid-60s?
Yes. Wow. And these prostitutes, they were lovely. And they come and say... And this one came and said, what are you doing, darling? You look a bit young. And they were very friendly. They said, you had something to eat? I said, bought me my first big hamburger. And you coke here? And she said, wait here, I'm just going to do a job. She'd go and do a job, she'd come back, and she's really kind to me. So all day I sat there and they were feeding me and everything, and then I thought, well, it's getting a bit dark here. And that prostitute said, do you have anywhere to stay? I said, oh, not really. She said, she gave me $10 out of her, which was a bit of money, out of her, but she said, here. She said, now you go down here, and she took me to the corner of where the... Yes, what's it called? It's still there.
Yeah, there's the Wesley Mission and Salvation Army also.
No, yeah.
It's definitely the Wesley Mission.
Yeah, but it's called something else. Anyway, and you go in there and that famous bloke, Knopfs.
Ted Knopfs Foundation.
Yeah, I didn't know this at the time. And you go in and then he calls you and yes, can I have it? Very friendly, very kind. And I said, oh, well, I'm from Darwin, and I felt a bit shame, you know, but I thought, no, I have to. And that's what got me through things. I just thought, no, as Dad was, I just ask. And I said, I got no money. He said, no worries. Do you have an address for some friend? I said, oh, I do. So they gave me $20. And he said, all right, my boy, get this, get a taxi, and take you to this house. It was the house of a white friend who worked at the airport in the tower. And he was good pals with my father. So they lived there in, not Bondi.
Somewhere, one of the suburbs of Sydney.
Very inner suburb. And I just walked up, got there and I walked on by the door and I said, and I had to call him Uncle Jack. Uncle Jack. Gary! You know, I knew, I used to babysit his kids and his wife was English. She was gorgeous, blonde English woman. And I said, oh, well, what are you doing? But I think my father had rang him because he gave me his address and then he rang him.
They knew you were running. You weren't running away. You were just, you wanted to...
And I said, yes, we've got a room for you. There's room downstairs.
Your mum and dad knew you were off and they didn't object to you leaving?
No. They said, all right, if you want to do that.
2016.
Because I was working in the Nondreland in Prep. The Prep laundromat, which is now an art gallery, which that same sign is there. But anyway, I've written a...
So you already finished school, you're working in the laundromat.
When I was 16, and the year I turned 16 was the year that they changed the law in the Northern Territory where you could leave school at 16 if you had a job. And 18th of May came and I said to my father, I went to knock on the room there. I said, Dad, Mum, I said, I want to leave school. And my father, you know, he's so cool. He said, that new law, eh? I said, yes. I said, I'm 16 now. He said, and have you got a job? I said, no, but the next day he came back. He said, I've got you a job. Where, Dad? Geez, food centre. Prep, fine food, that building in Prep. Ginny's, G and David and Cindy G. And Cindy G, Chinese Darwin born, was born in Prep Camp.
So hello, Gary.
Come. And she had all the boys, all the girls. They were great. Did all that. So,
had a job and it was working at it.
Had a job, yeah. And so I did that. And then my father, he was telling
me about the circus in Sydney. We're in Sydney, and
I went down and got the job. And then I was looking for a paper so that Uncle Jack could bring me papers, Sydney Morning Herald, yeah, like lots of jobs. And I was looking, oh, there's plenty. And then there's one that wanted roustabout. What the roustabout? And, you know, it's this and that, and you get your board and everything, and come. So I talked to this Uncle Jack, and he said, well, do you think you can do that? I said, yeah. I said, what rouse about? You know, to help on, all right. He must have rang up, and the bloke rang back. He said, yes, okay. How old is he, and blah, blah, blah. It must be like he was sort of like father figure. All right, okay, he's got a job. We're leaving for Bathurst tomorrow. Bathurst, didn't know where it was. And we would come by and pick him up. Here's the address. All right, we'll come there. Next minute, this big truck came by and there was all these horses on the back, you know, horse track.
Yeah, floats, but they carry horses in there. Yeah.
And the big adult horses in the street. And they said, yeah, here's your gift, guy. So I got in there and sitting at the big truck and climb up and in it was this huge, big Irish man. He was about 60. Frizzy hair, he was big, and he was a boss. And don't you find it, kept everything slip. And he looked at me when I walked in, and I thought, oh, he might. I used to think, oh, maybe they don't like coloured people, but nothing. It was nothing. He said, where are you from, my boy? And I said, oh, I'm from Darwin. Darwin, anyway, come in. So there I was off to Bathurst, and then I met the crew, and they were a motley crew. Some were really ex-crims, some were ex-I don't know what, and yet they were so sweet to me. So you eat that sort of food, it's like big mobs of sliced bread, big mobs of salmon Devon, cheese, tomato sauce, and that's about it.
How long were you in the circus?
I was in there for about 9 months because And then after about a week, I said, and his wife, his wife had the ultra size. She sold potato chips. Now, you can buy chips anywhere, but at that time it was very rare. And she had an old, and she, and they were making a fortune. That make
potato chips. You mean like chips?
Potato chips.
Yeah, the deep fried ones.
Yes, and there were no many around that, and they were doing it, and they were killing it. So much so that we had to do it. All the money wouldn't fit in the till, so we just dropped the money on the floor. And there was all this money all on the floor, the thing we had to...
Chips, just potato chips, hot chips.
Yes, hot chips. So, and then I said to... She was lovely, Jean. She had a bit of a limp, but she was sweet. She was gentle and not like when I heard Frank about, you know, yelling at these workers. But when he came in, he talked to me very gently, not the last sweet. And then I said to her, Jean, we're having a bit of a break in the chip van. And I said, you know, I can cook, you know, because I could cook curry and all dough and stuff. And she said, oh, what kind of furry? What kind of meat? I said, well, with rice, and this could be a curry. And she was just staring at me. I thought, I'd do this. I said, can you? I said, yes. So she said, would you like to cook a curry for me and Frank, her husband? And they had a daughter and a son. I'll tell you about them. So
you became the cook?
Well, not really. I became their cook. Because when I cook...
And this is the manager, effectively, and his wife.
Yes.
Whatever you call a circus manager.
And he was the owner of the thing. And I thought, well, he knows what's what. And I cooked this big curry, down curry and rice. I never saw them eat rice. They probably don't eat much rice, but me, living on rice. And I put it there, and there were the four of them, the mum and father and the girl and the boy. The girl was about 16, 17. The boy was just about to be conscripted, poor thing. He didn't want to. He got killed in Vietnam. Anyway. And I cooked this curry. And they didn't say anything. They opened it. Wow.
They loved it.
They loved it. Oh, can you cook it tomorrow? Well, I can cook this. Oh, one thing I said to them one time. I can cook bully beef and rice.
Mm.
Bully beef, what's that? Corned beef in...
The
old dad, yes, I know that. How many tins you need? And I said, about 10. All right. And I cooked up just a plain apple. Well, they absolutely thought it was lovely. And then
I got... staple bully beef and rice, isn't it? Like Catherine Way.
So I'd cook everything like that, and I'd love it. And then, but then there was a wage. It's lunchtime. And they... it wasn't very much, but she said, Jane said, the wife, Mum, if you like to, I'll keep your money. You don't have to spend anything. And it's like a saving thing. And I said, all right then. So I didn't miss it. And I built up this little bit of money. By the time I... You're right. By the time, so that was okay. We went all around New South Wales, Victoria, some of the most racist little town. We went to, the first time I ever saw Coolab, it was past Bourke. We pulled into this town. This is where the circus was setting up for a week. And then we went in, and the girl, what was her name? I forget her name. She had her own big semi. She knew she was drawing them since she was 10 or something. So she pulled up in the main street outside of Hamburger Place. Now, I've just been introduced to hamburgers, and I just absolutely adore hamburgers. And said, do you want a hamburger? Yes. Well, come on then. Went into the... And you know what? She didn't do it, but I felt something. because the way that all people look at me, I thought, I don't feel like I want to be here. And the buddy said, two hamburgers. He said, two. Who's the other one? Like, two. Who's the other one? And he looked over at me. But she was a bit, she said, to my friend. So he didn't say nothing. When he came out, I looked out. I didn't see it before, looked out. And opposite was another milk bar. All the blacks were there. And I thought, what's going on? Not as flash as this one. And I said, oh, is there another? I said, oh, no, no. They, you know, they're not allowed to come in here and all this. That's the first experience I had of it. And I thought, that's wrong. And then I noticed it. When we go to these places, the Aboriginal people would be there, but the white people were there. They were white.
Segregation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was terrible. Very, very much in outback New South Wales. Oh. Very present.
But it was a shock to me. So, but by the time I had received two letters from Uncle Jerry. Now, when he went to London, he went overland.
This is your mother's
brother.
Dad's brother.
The blonde one.
Blonde, blue eyes.
Yes. And he used to, before he went, he said to me, here you are. He gave me a record player. I was eight. And it was one of those ones where it was electric, and you put it was very old-fashioned, you put the thing. And then he said, here you are, in a box. And it's a box of all his EP records that he meticulously catalogued and everything in the box. And he said, and he said,
his entire record collection and his record player.
He said, these are for you, all right? He said, you know how to operate? I said, yes, uncle. Oh, I had my own. I was eight. And you know what was in that album? It was all Billie Holiday, all old jazz songs. And I had never really heard of it. So I put Billie Holiday on. Well, and all those old jazz songs, and the other one was Mal Tormo and Perry Como and all those. But those records, so anyway, I did that. So he was sending me two letters, and I sent a letter from India, and Dad was saying to, I'll ring up home, and I said, oh, you know, I think I want to, and he was giving me an idea that, you know, and he was saying, you should come. He said, travel, you know, don't.
This is your Uncle Jerry. Yeah.
And he really encouraged me. That's what it's like a second father's piece.
You have travelled. I mean, you went to India. You spent a year in Calcutta. So when did, I'm just, what I actually want to talk about is when you realised you were gay. And because I
and
think...
how did it rain?
Well, yeah, how did you make it through? Just briefly, like...
You see...
Because I know there was a beat here and there were places
so
to...
We hadn't discovered that. And then when I was 12, my friend, there's always a white friend, passing, pardon, darling, he's...
Sorry, Gary, I've run out of tape.
Oh no! Oh well. Sorry, I should have rated.
We'll just stop there. We'll just stop there, and we'll go to tape two.